Welcome to the Smart Tech Check podcast, hosted by Mark Vina, your home for candid, insightful, and provocative conversations about the smart home, home automation, security, smartphones, PC and console gaming, and much more.
Hi, everyone. My name is Mark Vina, host of the Smart Tech Check podcast. Today's Thursday, March 20th, 2025. Joining me for today's podcast are Stuart Walpin, who scribes for Popular Mechanics, AARP, Techlicious, Investopedia, and other great publications. Rob Peguero, who writes about tech developments at PC Mag, Fast Company, and other publications. And John Quain, who writes for the New York Times, Smart Cities, and Tom's Guide. Guys, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Good.
Good. Very good.
Waiting for baseball season to start.
Yeah. John, as you can see,
tied for first place on opening day.
I was about to say, as you can see, John is drinking. That's why the webcam.
That's right.
I hate this period of the year because it's that period between the Super Bowl's over. You know, basketball doesn't really drive me crazy. We do have the NCAAs, which will be kind of fun, but you know, it's a hard, 8 week period for me.
And it's cold outside.
Yes. Yes.
It's Formula One. There's all the Formula One races. Formula One's back.
You know, and by the way, as you've got, as you know, the A's are moving to Las Vegas and they're building this, what looks like
they cleared the lot.
Oh my God. Well, they've already began construction. They're still 2 years out, but if it's typical Vegas, it's going to be a video game ballpark. I mean, the entire roof looks like it's going to be, it's a screen.
As I recall, it'll have a view of the skyline of New York, the casino.
Yes. And by the way, the capacity of the stadium is only 33,000. It's like a Fenway Park. Oh yeah, which is really strange. You would think they would. I mean, in comparison, Reliant across the street has. I think they could put 80,000 in there. But we'll see what happens. So anyway, let's get to the topics at hand here. I got you teed up, Rob. You want to talk a bit about Barcelona and MWC?
Yeah. Shockingly enough, I'm not going to lead with AI. MWC, the show that used to be called Mobile World Congress, had me in Barcelona, one of my favorite parts of the world, very start of March. Instead, so much of the conversation was about satellite to phone connectivity, where so far a lot of the attention has been paid to Starlink since they have this big beta opening up with T-Mobile for text messaging only. But Skylo, the company that provides the emergency SOS messaging service to Pixel 9 phones and the Galaxy S25 series, they're now expanding that to plain old text messaging. Just yesterday, Verizon announced that if you have those phones, you're on their network, and you are somewhere where their signal doesn't reach you, you can then send your message via satellite, which in Skylo's case is neat because they're not doing with low Earth orbit satellites. Geostationary Earth orbit. So it is a 44,000-mile round trip. And I kind of can't believe that this computer, that this thing can somehow pick up a signal from 22,000 miles away and then send one back. I also talked to Globalstar, the company that provides the messaging behind newer iPhones. Both Skylo and Globalstar, they say they can deliver data within constraints. And for that matter, there's also AST Space Mobile, which launched their first 5 satellites. They're going to provide voice, data, texting, the whole thing for AT&T and Verizon. They have to launch a bunch more satellites, but not as many as Starlink. They have 5 up right now. They say they need 45 to do preliminary service. And since they're actually aiming to go to market with, actual roaming, not just texting only, it'll be really interesting to see how that works out. At scale.
Was there anything that jumped out at you that was you didn't expect to see at MWC?
So one thing that definitely did, I'll give you 2 examples. One of them is just in phones alone. Historically, if you have an Android phone, there is the version of Android that Google has out and puts out for their Pixel series phones right away, and then what you might have on your own. And this year, pretty much every phone vendor I looked at, the phones on display, had the current Android 15 installed. The one exception is Motorola, which is funny because that's the company that Google owned not too many years ago in an attempt to get into the more mass market of phones before selling it off to Lenovo. And the other one, speaking of Android, is Huawei, which You may remember, we thought we kind of exiled them, the Google ecosystem. Their exhibit in the first hall of the convention center was bigger than ever. It's packed. The company has showrooms. Like if you go on like the fanciest shopping street in Berlin, Huawei has a very shiny showroom, Apple Store-esque right there. I do not know why you want to buy one of their phones. You can't use the Google Play Store. The software quality is suspect. You have a lot of other options, but they're still around. So that's interesting. Which, of course, I should note, FCC Chair Brendan Carr gave a speech where he talked about, you know, we're moving ahead with getting on trusted hardware over networks. The EU representative on the same panel also spoke about security risks, didn't say the H word, Huawei. But that discussion isn't going away. But I think clearly the idea that we can just sort of blackball them out of the phone ecosystem is not really working out.
Right.
Right. Well, the satellite stuff is really interesting because, you know, T-Mobile has been touting it for a year now or something. Yeah. I like competition. Obviously, anybody who wants to compete against Starlink is all right by me. But the great thing about the Starlink deal with T-Mobile is it works on pretty much any phone.
Yep.
Any phone that is working now will work on that system and text. And that's a super game changer in terms of emergency situations. I'm currently in Vermont, and much of Vermont is a black hole as far as cellular service goes. Most of the state, you can't get a cell signal. And if you're in trouble, that's a great service to have. You don't need a new phone, which I think is great. On the other hand, it takes a gazillion satellites, all reflecting light and distorting images in the sky. Some of them falling already, you know, so there's that side of it. So interesting that the people are pushing it. The old geosynchronous direct, do you remember direct TVs, PC? I used that up here a long time ago. That 44,000 mile circuit is a big delay. I mean, it's a horrible delay. So just to let people know, that's not going to be for voice. That's not going to be a thing. That's for sure.
That it sort of gets left out a lot. The trade-off, though, you know, Starlink, yeah, it's works on unmodified phones. AST is taking the same approach. They can't go global with that. Whereas Skylo and Globalstar, they're using spectrum that was licensed like 30 years ago, cleared around the world for direct-to-device use. So they can have an economy of scale that Starlink can't. Now, I don't think Starlink is hurting. They're getting massive uptake on airlines in particular. United put it on their first regional jet 2 or 3 weeks ago. Qatar Airways has it on theirs as well. I tried it on a flight to Doha a month ago, which worked amazingly well. Air France has taken it also. Airlines that don't have Starlink and are relying on these older geostationary services are going to be at a disadvantage. Not that that is necessarily going to drive people's booking decisions, but you'll know when you're on board and you have this really slow uplink and the downloads themselves are nothing.
You know, Rob, one question for you before we move to the next topic, which is going to be fun. The next topic is going to be fun. You mentioned before the podcast started that the White House's decision to use Starlink was a questionable decision.
Yep.
Perfectly. So please provide that point of view.
Yes. So the New York Times broke this story. Makes no sense at all. Allegedly, they have Starlink set up, but you're not going to see an actual Starlink terminal on the roof of the White House or the Eisenhower Executive Office Building. It's set up at some offsite facility, which is connected to the White House by fiber optic cable. And that's the problem. The White House already has really good bandwidth. And the explanations offered in this piece from White House officials like Caroline Leavitt, the press secretary, poor cell phone reception, which Starlink won't solve. It only does text service to some T-Mobile phones supported right now, and that the Wi-Fi is not good, which you don't fix. Like, my Wi-Fi is not that great, and my fix is not to get a faster Fios connection. I need to deploy mesh, or really, when we had this home office set up, should have run Ethernet to it in the first point. I don't know why I didn't. So it seems like a really strange experiment, and like, if Elon Musk doesn't want people to think he's self-dealing, maybe don't do stunts like this, which make absolutely zero sense from just a network planning perspective.
Well, it's definitely self-dealing, right? He just gave the president's PACs $100 million extra. And then the next day, Oh, magically, he's on the front lawn with Tesla vehicles. Don't scratch me.
In context, and also, like, I've seen him talk about it 5 years ago, 5 years ago to the day. He was introducing it at the last public event it went to before the world shut down because of the pandemic. And he said, this is really only intended for rural areas, for the very hardest places to reach.
Right. And that's why I was one of the very first people to test it here. Very first people. And, you know, it does have problems with that downlink software. So that's why it has problems with video conferencing calls sometimes and stuff. So I know it's a super weird thing. And guess what we have now in the country? Cable, baby. We're rocking. So thank you, Joe Biden. We have cable here. That's why we have cable, that infrastructure bill. And all these people in Vermont have it. So that's a great thing. Just saying.
Hey, actually, can I interject?
Go ahead, sir.
I want to interject a question and a comment. The first comment is obviously the satellite, they're interrelated. The satellite infrastructure that is being built now is really fragile because of the amount of stuff that is going up into space junk. You have all these new GPS satellites going up, radio community. There is so much junk going up into space now that, you know, you remember the movie Gravity, where
I was just gonna say, yes,
right. I mean, it that over and above sun activity and sun flares and changes in the magnetic poles and all this, that's a very, very fragile ecosystem to be basing secure earthbound communications on. The second thing in relation to that, when is Amazon supposed to be launching their satellite Wi-Fi service, which is going to make things worse and, I don't know, better because there'll be more choice. But I mean, the sky is filling up with all sorts of unpredictable things, and it's already filled with a lot of old stuff that is playing ping pong or a pinball up there that could create a catastrophic series of failures.
Yeah.
Well, they're particularly bad users of space in terms of not disposing of spent rocket stages. Also, they're not great at taking suggestions from us, so it is a problem. AST, yeah. I do like they're at a higher altitude. They're about 900 miles or so up instead of 350 for Starlink. So we're not all in the same bands, but yeah, there's a lot of space in space, to quote Wally, but not infinite, not in lower.
Not infinite, yeah.
Guys, we gotta go to the next topic, but Rob, all I'll tell you is you scared me now, because I'm sure that after that public announcement was made about Starlink, the Russians recalibrated a lot of missiles at Starlink satellites.
Oh, definitely.
God forbid. All right, this is a sad topic in many ways.
I mean, yeah.
I'll just go off of this. I mean, to me, the whole Skype, and the greater point really is Microsoft, just yet another example. The big company acquires at the time the fledgling video conferencing technology called Skype years and years ago. It wasn't like 2 months ago, years ago. And they completely botched it. And even and despite all that, you know, Skype, until Zoom came along, was pretty much was a very favorite application for many people. Now, we could quibble about the user interface, the very 1990s. And it was hard to sometimes add contacts and things like that. But the point I'm making is Microsoft was there before anybody, and I think they botched it up, you know. And it's going to be so. To me, it's a sad story. So I'll let John kind of go to town.
All right. Yeah. Well, I mean, so first things first. Full disclosure: I was actually hired by Skype back in the day. So I worked for them for a while. So I just want people to know that. And because those guys, if people will remember, they did this file sharing service too for a music service. One of them did. And so there were threats about arresting them. They couldn't leave the country, Estonia. And there was all this stuff going on. Anyway, at the time I was trying to convince people, because I believed it was a great technology, which was video conferencing, you know, and people didn't really get it until the pandemic. So that was really, you know, what's happened. And to your point, you're absolutely right. They didn't leverage the technology. They didn't do very much with it at all. And so along came the pandemic, and it was, you know, multi-point, what we used to call multi-point. Zoom was a multi-point system, and Skype was really designed for kind of one-on-one calls, video calls. So that was a big factor, I think. I like the interface. I'm trying to make the change because they're going to abandon Skype. And I use Skype all the time for one-on-one calls and trying to pick these other ones. Oh, my goodness. You know, Zoom, not really a good starter. Teams is awful. Crashes systems, doesn't like to play well with others, all that stuff. So right now it's WhatsApp. Seems to be the only one.
That's a very, very good point. I mean, I had a call this morning with Teams. Teams is awful.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's not like they've learned their lesson.
No. Yeah. Yeah. So it's very frustrating. A lot of people use Teams because their company does. And so those are the calls. And WebEx was this huge, hulking, kludgy, oh my goodness, you know, but an old fashioned networking company, you know, designed it. So it's really not much better. So I don't know what people are doing. We're kind of going to WhatsApp. I don't know, you know, for those one-on-one calls with relatives and friends. Signal. Yeah, that's another one, especially as we travel to some foreign lands, if we could get it to work. But yeah, so it is a sad day. I'm sorry to see it go. They did warn us. Microsoft planned to shut it down way before the pandemic. Actually, they had planned to shut it down earlier. And then the pandemic came along and was like, well, maybe not. So anyhow, yeah, I'm sorry to see it go.
So Definitely. Stuart, I want you to start playing taps. What's your POV?
Well, it's funny. I was thinking about this when we start. I knew I wanted to talk about this to a certain extent, but what struck me is that this is an old story in technology, that most technologies last usually from 20 to 30 years before they are usurped by the next generation, whether it was radio being usurped by TV, whether it was film photography being usurped by digital photography, whether it was analog music being replaced by digital music. The lifespans are almost predictable to a certain extent, but this story reminds me much more of the Kodak film to digital story. Having Kodak invented the digital camera, and they invented most of the technology like the color CCD that goes into it. But they were so afraid of cannibalizing their film business that they sat on it and allowed other companies to take advantage of it, to the point where by the time Kodak decided, oh, maybe we should get into this digital camera thing, it was too late already. And I think that is exactly what happened with Microsoft and Skype. I don't think Microsoft knew what they had. Not that there was a competing thing that they were afraid of cannibalizing, but it also reminds me of Microsoft's attempt to create a mobile operating system back in the day. And they said it wasn't their business, and they started at the wrong end. They started to convert a desktop experience to the mobile instead of starting mobile from scratch, which is what Apple and eventually what Android did. And I think the same thing happened here with this. I don't think that Microsoft understood what it had until it was too late. And it's unfortunate because Skype made FaceTime possible. And I think Apple had a lot to do with Skype's demise when it became device oriented as opposed to system oriented, where you just could pick up any Apple device and you could do it without Skype. And finally, I'll say is I think Skype still owes me money. I still have credit on Skype. So what happened with that?
I got 11 cents on it. Yeah.
So guys, the question I have for Rob is this truly then a story of big hulking successful company buys a small company? And even though the big successful companies have a lot of smart people, there are a lot of smart people that work at Microsoft, that even smart people can make bad decisions in terms of not getting video conferencing to the next level, which Microsoft could have added value, but they really didn't. I'm kind of just letting
Microsoft let it go. Is not the only story to make that mistake. I mean, sorry, I got a call coming in here.
I'm stuck.
You can generate that with the test audio button in the Skype settings. I had to bring that little audio. Google, how many different video messaging platforms have they turned through?
The
only thing that makes Microsoft look halfway competent in their stewardship of Skype is Google.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they didn't screw it up, but there was that. But Stuart, you're absolutely right. The whole, if anybody remembers those first smartphones, were really Microsoft had the maps. Yeah. They had the technology. They had the graphic user interface. And they were like, dude, I wonder what we should do with these maps on a smartphone. Maybe nothing. I was like, so frustrating. So yeah, you're absolutely right.
Not to put the entire problem on Microsoft, but if you flash back to that period of time, what was it, 20 years ago, when Microsoft thought they had a play in the burgeoning smartphone category, they didn't have a chip. Intel did not have a chip. Yeah. That you could have a practical phone with you know, they didn't have an SoC, you know, frankly. And of course, you know, you got to give Apple credit, you know, in the fact that they had the ingredients and they had the courage, frankly, to pull that together. But, you know, Microsoft wasn't the only, not victim, but they were only not the only the problem player. I mean, you could argue that Intel didn't have, you know, didn't call it, and you know, the rest is history. So,
yeah. Anyway, bye-bye, Skype.
Goodbye, Skype. That's all right. Goodbye. That's all right. So, guys, don't know if you watched the Jensen Wang show, which is otherwise known as NVIDIA GC25. I have to say this because I did an interview with ABC a couple days ago, and you know, I've watched his keynotes for 10 years in a row, and it's the Jensen show. And, you know, he gets on there, and apparently he did say something that was interesting. He doesn't have prepared notes. It's all off the top of his head. I'm sure he rehearses it quite a bit, but that's very unusual for a CEO and a keynote at a major product platform announcement. And it could show because it almost went on for 3 hours.
It was a violation right there.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
But you know, again, and I don't know, Rob, if you, I don't think you said you saw it yet, but I guess.
No, I don't want to. 3 hours? Come on, man.
Well, maybe you can go on YouTube. You have the guys on YouTube that will condense it down to like the 9 minutes you want to watch.
Give me the super cut of every time.
Can we get an AI summary?
AI.
But the two things I were impressed with is that since they were scared shitless, frankly, about 2 months ago with DeepSeek. DeepSeek, of course, it was trying to kind of deflate the NVIDIA value proposition by coming up with a stronger performance with a lower spec, ironically, in NVIDIA chips, but lower, older generation NVIDIA chips. And that kind of freaked them out. They took a major hit in the market. I was fully expecting them to come back a bit with, well, the way we're going to combat that, you know, since we have 90% market share in the data center category, we come back with maybe more affordable pricing on our existing stuff. But they didn't do that. I mean, the path they went down is that they believe scalability being much more higher and higher performance, and they've got some next generation architecture that will succeed Blackwell. So it's about a year and a half out, 2 years out, that will get to number of token transactions that are beyond belief. And that's going to require a level of power they believe now they've even underestimated right now. But the flip side that I was impressed with is they're now embracing, working with TSMC, they're embracing photonics. And photonics is really a Star Trek, Lost in Space type of technology where it's using lasers or light, for lack of a better phrase, to transmit data, which can be incredibly, it's expensive to implement. But from an efficiency standpoint, once you get that going, it actually has tremendous scale associated with it. So the play is bigger scale drives overall lower costs, with better chips. So it's kind of an interesting type of thing. They did announce they're doubling down on getting in the robotics category. They had kind of a cute Wall-E like robot that was kind of bouncing around at the end of the broadcast. But let me start with John. John, do you have any thoughts on NVIDIA in general? Did you get a chance to watch any of the keynote?
I didn't get a chance to watch the keynote, unfortunately. But after your description of it, I'm glad I didn't see it. I mean, he's still wearing the leather jacket and all that, right? I think they need to look forward. Obviously, photonics, mostly in interconnects and computers, were really the thing for a while. And quantum computing is still out there, but not any time in the near future. So definitely in interconnects, and other companies, NTT and companies like that are working hardcore on photonics. So it is becoming a practical thing. It's also much more energy efficient. So that's a huge, huge element of it. And I think that's a doable and achievable goal. I think they should be afraid. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I've been trying other AI things that are flirting out there. And even though the companies aren't saying it outwardly or explicitly, they're working with a lot less computing power. So Malay and other ones like that are working with a lot less computing power. It's not, you know, Rob has pointed this out before, and Stuart about the power consumption. It's not feasible to build these data centers and run better ChatGPT. That's not going to happen. That can't be the way they go forward because there just isn't the power for it. So then what do we do? So they're going to be using less CPUs, less GPUs. That's just going to be something that's going to happen. But yeah, I don't think NVIDIA deserved that hit in the market, but I think people do need to be aware of what the future is really going to look like, and it's going to look different.
And I think that's right. I mean, anybody who knows anything about marketing and business is that when you have 90% share, that's great. But only companies have that 90% share. It can only go one direction down. And typically the way a company has to respond is they have to respond with some type of changes to their pricing and their business model. I'm not hearing that quite yet. So they're still trying to maintain that share presence. But that, I mean, at the end of the day, to expect any company to protect 90% share. I mean, I can't think of a company. That might be the outlier, but I can tell you at Synaptics, for example, when I ran the PC business, we had 85% share of the touchpad space. And we were afraid, by the way, this is an interesting observation. We were afraid at getting to 90, 95%. There were only a couple of players that competed with Synaptics and touchpads. One was a company called Lontech, and I forget the other company, but they had very small. They generally were outliers. But we were afraid to get to north of 90% because we were afraid that would attract the attention of the Justice Department. You know, so we kind of liked the, hey, you know what? You want 15% of the market, you can have it. That kind of thing.
Right.
Stuart, your thoughts?
Well, it's funny, as a tech historian, and I'm sorry to keep pounding on this, but this is such a familiar story.
You're a graybeard, man.
Yeah, literally and figuratively. I mean, going back to the invention of radio in the 1920s, these are all convergences of technology, high-priced technology coming down in price, infrastructure being built, and content being supplied. And you had this with radio, you had it with television, with color television, with the internet. All of these progressive technologies, a cell phone, they all start with something very expensive and very hard to do with very little infrastructure. And over a period of time, all of those problems either tend to get solved, multiple ecosystems come together to join, like with the smartphone. So I think we're at the stage of AI in about where we were, say, with color television in 1955. There were very few shows done in color. The color televisions were very expensive. But over time, we got the transistor instead of the vacuum tube. And then we got better color. We got more television networks producing color programming. So I think AI is just one of those technologies that we're still very much in the beginning of. And not only are the players still forming, remember that the invention of the cell phone, Motorola had 65% of the car phone business. And the only reason they came up with that was because they were afraid AT&T was going to clean their clock by getting a monopoly on the new cell phone. So I think you're seeing a lot of similar battles here going on with AI, with different companies trying to get monopoly spots, content being usurped. I mean, there's this big movement on the AI to have the administration sort of cut back on the AI regulations to make all content available regardless of copyright. So you're having the same content, infrastructure, and technology, which includes energy problems, that all these other technologies, the telegraph, the printing press, they're all really analogous. And if you just go back and look at how all of these technologies progress, you'll see almost the same thing happening in the world of AI.
So the question I have for Rob before we move to the next topic is that even though you haven't seen it after my great review of the the keynote, and I could, you're going to immediately make this observation 2 minutes into it. And by the way, the reporter from ABC said the exact same thing to me before we did the interview with him. His keynotes, if you've ever seen a Jensen Huang NVIDIA keynote, are aimed at very technical audience, partially at the business community, but it's not an end user friendly type of keynote. I mean, a lot of the material will go over your heads, of course, but will go over the head of the average.
It's no Steve note.
But speaking to Stuart's point, do you think that maybe not that Jensen's open to advice, but do you think that you'd accelerate the consumer's embrace of AI if companies like NVIDIA, which is an ingredient company in the AI equation, that they did a better job of articulating, you know, the usage models, articulating, hey, here's how it's going to, rather than speak at it at 50,000 feet, get down a little bit lower, because I just think it was a missed opportunity, frankly.
Yeah. So a couple thoughts. Number one, I think NVIDIA, it does seem just from the I was at an AI conference in your neck of the woods last week, HumanX in Vegas, and there was a lot of talk. I did one panel, which had the CEO of a company called Deep Matrix that does more efficient, I think, inference-based, if I have that correct, AI processors. I did another panel 3 weeks ago with the CEO of Cerebra Systems, same sort of thing. They're trying to sort of, you know, zig where NVIDIA zags, which is what you do when you're the challenger company and the incumbent has 75%+ share of the market. Go after the market they haven't addressed. And in that case, smaller, more efficient. To me, some of the most interesting stuff. And here, you know, Apple and Google can be constructive on device AI, where number one, your data isn't going anywhere. So it's not my voice is getting piped into a data center somewhere, actually 30 miles west of Northern Virginia, where it's going to run up everybody's electric bills. It's happening right on my tablet, on my phone, on my laptop. Number two, hopefully you see something useful. That's not always the case. Earlier today, I got an email from a local user group. They want to know, could I go out and give them a talk? And Apple Intelligence, ever helpful, it suggests two beginnings to my reply. I'm available to, or I'm not available to. It's not a good demo of AI. Do something useful. And just local stuff, like, you know, make sense of my inbox. I always joke that the use case in waiting to see somebody address is, make sense of these 600 messages I get about CES every December. Tell me where I should go. We're not there yet. In general, the AI industry, not so much NVIDIA, but guys like Sam Altman at OpenAI, they do these hand-wavy gestures about, you know, artificial general intelligence, AGI, and it'll change everything, or it might, you know, kill all human life on Earth. These guys should shut up. They're not helpful. They're freaking people out, including my mom, I should note. Talk about, and if you don't want to talk about on device, AI is doing probably really useful work in stuff like medical research.
Oh yeah.
You know, going through lots of data about what is the effectiveness of this new drug under consideration, what are the causes of this disease. We have an enormous amount of data that is hard for human brains to process at scale. AI can help with that.
Right.
So focus on that. Focus on, you know, make sense of my messages. Shut up about AGI, please.
No, I think we got to move to the next topic, not next and last topic, but I think you make a great point, because in my unscientific analysis, when I speak to people who are not in our industry, and we talk a little bit about AI, because, oh, Mark, you're in the space, what do you think? Generally, their first reaction is, yeah, there's some pluses, but it's all going to be like the movie Terminator, and we're all going to die at the end. And that's not the right. That's
one,
not
one other
right.
One other point, Mark. It's almost all technology is the surprisingly killer usage case. The killer app for any technology often comes from very unexpected sources. And I keep thinking of the early days of the home, the personal computer business, where every cynic in the country kept saying, why does anybody need a computer at home? And here we are. So yes. Breakthroughs, those user cases, come from unexpected sources.
The industry is in search of that Lotus 1-2-3 killer app, that, or VisiCalc in the early days.
Or Word. Word perfect.
I can't believe I said VisiCalc. I now completely dated myself. Stuart, you got to talk me through this because I saw, you know, you alerted me to this. This to me sounds like there's a gotcha here. But talk to me about what BYD is doing here that I can charge a car battery in 5 minutes. I might even buy an EV if that's true.
Well, I think one of the bugaboos, and this is going to sound very strange coming from somebody who hasn't owned a car in 40 years. But one of the problems that at least I've seen from a technology and a user take-up problem with electric vehicles is that they have this perceived range problem, and that once you go a certain distance and you can't recharge the car and you just have to stop. Whereas an electric vehicle, you stop at a gas station, you fill up and you keep on going. What BYD seems to have come up with, and they're going to be releasing cars with this technology before the end of this year, is a new electronic car battery that charges at, instead of like 400 or 700 kilowatts, charges about 1,350 kilowatts, and they changed the chemistry and the construction of the battery that would allow the battery to recharge in 5 minutes, which means that you could now go to an electronic filling station, plug your car in, and fill up your car with electricity almost as fast or even faster than you would get if you needed to fill up your car with gas. Now, there are two problems. The first problem, obviously, it's one company, and I have yet to understand whether or not this is a patented technology, whether they're going to license technology, whether they're going to try to keep it on their own like LG did with OLED. And until LG let that cat out of the bag, OLED didn't really get out there in any kind of form. Same thing with plasma TV. Second thing is, because these charging stations are much higher power, they can't be run in the same way that current, like Tesla or any other electric vehicle, standalone charging. They almost have to have their own power station set up with it, which obviously a gas station, which would have the real estate at least to do it, and an improvement in the solar power technology, so you wouldn't be sapping all of that energy from the grid, which we're already having enough trouble with firing up and fueling the quantum computing and AI businesses. So those are the two problems, I think, is one, whether or not the technology will be hidden or kept up in this one company, and whether or not they figure out how to set up these charging stations that doesn't zap the local grid of all the power that's necessary to actually accomplish this.
The two questions for you that you didn't answer. Since it's a Chinese company, what safety issues, because you're charging the battery at a much higher rate, does it introduce safety?
Don't know yet because the products aren't out yet.
Okay.
Well, but they just say that they've announced it and it's going to be in two model cars coming out in China.
I'll wait for that to happen. And the second question is, does that affect the durability of the battery that you're charging it?
Again, I don't think they know. I'm sure they have done tests and I'm sure that they can speculate, but it's like anything else until you put it out there. When we do reviews of phones or vacuum cleaners or whatever, we use it for about 2 weeks and then we write our review. And then I don't know about you guys, but 3 months later, I would rather want to do an update on that going, thing didn't last, it got dirty, it fell down and it cracked immediately. The durability issue is almost always something that is always address much later. We always find that out much later.
So John, you're our resident car guy.
Right. So a number of car companies have announced similar kinds of things, some using solid state batteries, which you can charge much more quickly and are in some ways more efficient, but they're heavy. And typically solid state batteries have burned out a very short lifespan. So maybe they only last 5 years as opposed to eight or something in these lithium ion batteries. So that's an issue, definitely. But solid states are coming, and companies like Toyota and Honda are sort of counting on some of that technology. In the meantime, you know, there's a couple of elements that are going on. One is in the car. So the charger is really in the car. It's not in that stand you see at the corner or in the parking lot. That's just a hose, and that's the current coming through. And what Stuart was alluding to there too is like you need a lot of current if you're going to do these super fast charging. And even Tesla's stations don't have enough current. Their superchargers are not the fastest on the market. They are still lagging. And a Tesla example only, I think the Cybertruck is the only 800 volt system they have in a car. So that's why a Hyundai Ioniq 5 can get 80% charge in about 15 minutes. And a Tesla can't match that. And that's why, because the Hyundai Ioniq 5 has an 800 volt. So does a Taycan from Porsche. There's a way to do the Hummer that way. So there are a few cars in the market that do that. But consumers, you know, from a technology and consumer point of view, it's going to happen. I mean, it is coming. To Stuart's historical point, too, about this technology is they are going to introduce batteries and the charging systems that do it in 5 minutes. And that's just, you can see that as inevitable. How long it'll take them is a question mark. But, and then, you know, you're also right. You've got to wire these up. That cabling to do it in a parking lot is not cheap. So that's an issue. And will people really want it if they have chargers at home? I mean, I can charge a car in my home here in overnight, fully charged, no problem. You know, don't think twice about it. I don't need any special anything. A $500 charger. So, but it does alleviate the whole range anxiety idea, even if you only use it twice a year.
That would become the problem. Oh, no, you're right.
Yeah. Well, so that's, I think it's going to happen. It was really see how fast they get it out there. Speaking of fast.
Rob, we got a couple of minutes left. Take us home on this topic.
Yeah. I'm going to echo what JQ said. You know, if you have an EV and you have some place to park it that's off the street, you can put the equivalent of a gas station without the environmental problems right in your driveway. You charge at home. It's the cheapest way to do it. That's how my mother-in-law does it with her 2018 Tesla Model 3. And for most driving, that's all you need to do. Every morning you wake up, your car is fully charged.
Right.
It is an issue on road trips. I think the bigger issue is more availability of chargers where, you know, going up and down I-95, not a problem. They're all over the place. But like, you know, a month ago, I was skiing in Virginia, and I don't know how many there are in the Shenandoah Valley. It's probably thinner availability. And I should note my state's program to build up more with federal money is currently held up because the White House has decided to freeze all the current grants. Whatever they're doing. BYD stuff, it's interesting, but it's a non-factor because as a Chinese market OEM, they're tariffed out of existence here. And they're going to have the perception that, oh, if I get this, will I come down with the Xi Jinping thought after spending too many miles in the car? But I do think this is an area where a lot of smart brains in the auto industry are working towards the same goal, making this as easy as possible. I think in practice, anything around 15 minutes is good because you've been driving 200 miles, 150 miles. You got to go to the bathroom. You want to get a bite to eat. I like to take a nap while the car charges. Yeah. 15 minutes is probably good enough in practice. This is not like Cannonball Run where you better get charged in 5 minutes and get back on the road.
Yeah, I actually have had that experience in the 15 minutes. I wasn't done. Like I hadn't gotten my coffee yet and stuff. And I was like, wait, I'm not ready to unplug yet. So, yeah.
We're going to have to stop it there because Rob made a reference to Cannonball Run, which is for those moving like 57 years ago with Burt Reynolds and Don DeLuise, if I'm not mistaken.
Sally Field.
Yep.
No, she wasn't in Cannonball Run. That was Smoking the Bandit.
Smoking the Bandit.
Okay.
Oh.
Just got to correct you, Stuart. Well, guys, listen, thanks for taking the time to join me for today's podcast. For our viewing and listening audience, thanks for making the Smart Tech Check podcast part of your day or commute. Please make sure that you hit the like and subscribe buttons at the end of today's podcast, or use these on-screen QR codes to connect with me. You can also follow me on X at Mark Vina Tech Guy. And until next time, have a great week. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Take care, everyone.